The tape that you are about to hear has been declassified by disability and disadvantage analysts at CFMU Radio. This taped record of conversation had never been heard before being released to you, the CFMU listener. This tape has been condensed and edited from live, personal, or telephone conversation. You will hear privileged discussions, damning indictments, and stark revelations. Once known collectively only to the agents intercepting them, these files have been tagged with the distinct identifier, disrespect. We want to shout out to Maria this week, who's listening to our show for the first time. Disrespect welcomes Hazel Barton, an associate professor of biology and geology and environmental science.
Yes.
At the University of Akron. Well, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
All right. You mentioned that you've been going into caves since you were a teenager, but this time you went into a cave looking for bacteria and came back with bacteria that are immune to all the antibiotics that we normally use to fight disease in medicine. And you've mentioned to me this is important because the antibiotics that we do use are derived from bacteria. But these indicate there are antibiotics we haven't used or even thought of yet.
What we did was we collected bacteria from the cave, and so I'm interested in how microorganisms make a living when there isn't a lot to eat. So under extreme starvation, how do you go about making a living? And one of the best places you can do to get a really starved environment on Earth is to go underground. And obviously the reason for that is there's no light, so there's no photosynthetic input, there's no plants or any kind of organic material growing inside the cave.
All
and
right.
You've also, where we collected these microbes from, there's about 1,000 feet of rock between our sample site and where we collected them. So it's very, very isolated, and so they have to make a living down there.
All right.
And we think what they do is there's two kinds of ways of doing it. One is that you can play the game, and you can live in a community. So if you imagine like a city, you have experts who are good at growing crops and maybe packaging that up into food, and others that are important in removing the garbage and maybe recycling. And so everybody works together to make the city function. So we call that mutualism, where everybody is mutualistic. They work together to support the ecosystem.
All right.
The other thing you can do is you can cheat. So rather than being part of the community and contributing to the survival, you can, you know, basically steal food that you need. And, you know, in the process, you might even have to kill off a few people to get at that food.
Okay.
And so those are the competitors. And so what we think antibiotics are made by these competitors, in that if you want to cheat, you don't want to play the game, that doesn't work for you. Instead, what you do is you make these weapons, and you basically kill your neighbor and use their resources.
Okay.
And so that's basically where antibiotics come from.
Really?
They're made by organisms to steal other organisms' food. They're also made to defend themselves. So if you have an organism making antibiotics, you could also make your own antibiotic. And then when he comes to steal your food with his weapon, you've got an equally potent weapon and you can defend yourself. And so you kind of had this back and forth with antibiotics. And so as humans, we've taken advantage of that because we've recognized that microbes produce these. They're very, very specific. We don't have the targets for antibiotics. We as humans don't have the targets for antibiotics because the bacteria are so different from us in every way, in every structure.
Right.
So we can take these antibiotics. They won't kill us, but they'll kill bacteria.
Ah.
And so when we went into the cave to collect these organisms, we were interested in whether these organisms that are in a cave that's never been exposed to any modern antibiotic, they were collected from a location where no humans had really been. You can tell that in a cave because humans leave behind marks to show that they've entered an area. So we went to an area where there were no marks.
Right.
And we collected these organisms. We tested them to see. You've never been exposed to these things. They've never been exposed to anything that we use in the clinic, anything that a doctor could prescribe.
Yeah.
What are they resistant to?
Okay.
And it turned out they're resistant to virtually everything that doctors prescribe today.
Resistant to each other?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's almost like a germ warfare going on. Warfare that's going on in these environments.
It makes science fiction look boring.
As humans have been taking advantage of that since the discovery of penicillin.
Right.
It was discovered in the 1920s and, you know, used commercially and very important in the Second World War in the 1940s. And now people take it for granted. But what we've discovered is that resistance to these things, rather them being something that evolves or has evolved in the last 60 years since we've started using antibiotics in the clinic, because of this warfare between these microorganisms, it's likely that these kind of resistances are hardwired in. So no matter what drug you come up with, somewhere in the environment is an organism that is resistant to it, and so the resistance itself can make its way into the clinic. So these drugs that, you know, these new drugs that are being discovered, if we're not careful, can actually end up, we can develop resistance to them, and then they no longer become useful.
So this is not an adaptive change in the bacteria. This is an evolutionary change that just can be imported into the chain?
I think the way to look at it is when you think about microorganisms, you might think about a species. So you might think about maybe Salmonella and E. coli.
All right.
As individual species.
Right.
But they share 75% of their genetic material, and 25% is different.
Oh.
So they have a dramatic difference in what their capabilities are, but they're as close as you can possibly be as a bacteria.
Okay.
And that's because they diverged fairly recently, within the last few million years, from the same ancestor.
Okay.
The way to look at microbes rather than this kind of speciation is to imagine that there's this cloud of tools that exist. And a microbe in the environment, because they can share DNA in a way that we can't. I mean, we get all our DNA from our parents and we pass it on to our offspring.
Right.
We don't share our DNA around.
Okay.
Bacteria can do that.
Oh.
So if an organism dies in the environment, but it had, let's say, the gene that would allow you to breathe sulfur,
okay,
and you're in an environment where there's a lot of sulfur, if you pick that up, it allows you to do something that nobody else can do in that environment. And then you adapt and you become more fit for that environment, and then you will grow. And you've not really created a new species, but you've got a new adaptability.
Wow.
So when you imagine microorganisms in the environment, you imagine this cloud of capabilities that individual organisms are kind of sampling as the environment demands. And so antibiotic resistance is part of that cloud of tools and techniques that they can take advantage of. And so when you're in the hospital, organisms in that hospital environment, if they want to survive and they want to propagate and grow and spread as far as they can, they'll adapt and take on these resistances, because then they won't get cleared away and they get spread by patients in the clinic. And then you see this resistance come out into the environment and into the community, and you start to see a lot of people suffering from diseases that just a few years ago were not important.
Okay. It makes science fiction sound boring. Yeah, it's dramatic.
Microbiology is really having a renaissance. really, really starting to understand microbes in a way that we've never understood them before. And it's because, you know, until recently, they're so small, it's almost impossible to do anything with them.
All right.
But we've had this revolution in molecular biology and being able to manipulate DNA and study it at the individual organism level.
Right.
That we can now understand microorganisms in ways that, you know, even 20 years ago were unfathomable. You know, it's just, it's wild where microbiology has been in the last 20 years and where it's going to go.
Yeah, clearly. So the old model that we've been careless and self-indulgent is no longer seen to be the whole story, if it is even the major part of the story. The truth is that these bacteria have outsmarted us from the beginning, and we have to take account of how smart they are.
Yeah. What it is a cautionary tale, I think we should take out, that the reason we have so much antibiotic resistance is absolutely because of the inappropriate use of antibiotics.
Okay.
And so one of the things that we found was a drug which is considered a drug of last resort. So if they've tried everything else and you're on death's door and there's nothing they can do, they've got this one miracle drug.
Right.
And it's called Cubicin. And the actual chemical name is daptomycin, which I kind of like the antibiotic names. They all sound kind of cool, make you sound smart when you say them out loud.
All right.
But and nothing is resistant to this drug. I mean, it really is a miracle drug for a group of organisms because nothing is resistant to it.
Oh.
But when we pulled these bugs out of the cave, the microbes out of the cave, 80% were resistant to it.
Oh.
And they were resistant to it in a way that we didn't think possible.
Oh.
And so what we did was identify this pathway where this drug can be rendered inactive.
Right.
But what we're doing is we're seeing it 20 years before this becomes a problem for doctors.
Right.
So now we know how it works. We know how it inactivates a compound.
Right.
When we prescribe this drug, we can actually develop something which inactivates the inactivator and makes the drug useful again.
All right.
And they've done that with penicillin. So penicillin was this wonder drug for years, and now it's virtually useless to treat patients because so much is resistant to it.
Right.
And the resistance comes from a protein that actually inactivates penicillin. It cuts it in half and completely inactivates the antibiotic.
Wow.
And it's a protein that does this. Well, you can inactivate that protein quite easily with, I think it's clavulanic acid is the name of the acid, and just small doses of it will inactivate this inactivator.
Okay.
So now if you give penicillin with this inactivator,
right,
and they call it Augmentin. It's actually a drug that they've developed. They add this to penicillin, and they manufacture it as Augmentin. Penicillin becomes useful again.
Really?
And so what we can do is say, well, 20 years from now, this is going to be a problem. This is how it's going to be a problem, and this is what we can do to head this off.
Okay.
So I think you need to be careful. People need to say, well, okay, what we've got is we've got a head start. This is like one of those great chances where, okay, we can see this coming. We've got 20 years. We can be prepared so when it hits, it's not going to be a problem. Or we can already start developing this treatment to inactivate the inactivator, and it will never develop in the clinic. You'll always be able to use this drug. So I think the two take-home things are, yes, we've certainly abused antibiotics and not appreciated what miracle drugs they are. I mean, between antibiotics and vaccines, the mortality rate in a child under the age of 5 was 50%.
Really?
And now it's, you know, it's very, very rare to hear of somebody dying from an infectious disease.
Right.
And so these are really miracle wonder drugs, but they've got to be handled correctly. And we're getting a head start in how we can handle them correctly because of what the resistance we found in this cave.
Okay. So what does that mean for the use of antibiotics today? You said we'd have to be careful using antibiotics today. What does this mean for using antibiotics today, besides not taking them for a sore throat?
We need to be careful in that we only have a limited variety that's available. But And nothing is resistant to this drug. I mean, it really is a miracle drug for a group of organisms because nothing is resistant to it. Oh. But when we pulled these bugs out of the cave, the microbes out of the cave, 80% were resistant to it. Oh. And they were resistant to it in a way that we didn't think possible. Oh. And so what we did was identify this pathway where this drug can be rendered inactive.
Right.
But what we're doing is we're seeing it 20 years before this becomes a problem for doctors.
Right.
So now we know how it works. We know how it inactivates a compound.
Right.
When we prescribe this drug, we can actually develop something which inactivates the inactivator and makes the drug useful again.
All right.
And they've done that with penicillin. So penicillin was this wonder drug for years, and now it's virtually useless to treat patients because so much is resistant to it.
Right.
And the resistance comes from a protein that actually inactivates penicillin. It cuts it in half and completely inactivates the antibiotic.
Wow.
And it's a protein that does this. Well, you can inactivate that protein quite easily with, I think it's clavulanic acid is the name of the acid. And just small doses of it will inactivate this inactivator.
Okay.
So now if you give penicillin with this inactivator,
right,
and they call it Augmentin. It's actually a drug that they've developed. They add this to penicillin, and they manufacture it as Augmentin. Penicillin becomes useful again.
Really?
And so what we can do is say, well, 20 years from now, this is going to be a problem. This is how it's going to be a problem, and this is what we can do to head this off.
Okay.
So I think you need to be careful. People need to say, well, okay, what we've got is we've got a head start. This is like one of those great chances where, okay, we can see this coming. We've got 20 years. We can be prepared so when it hits, it's not going to be a problem. Or we can already start developing this treatment to inactivate the inactivator, and it will never develop in the clinic. You'll always be able to use this drug. So I think the two take-home things are, yes, we've certainly abused antibiotics and not appreciated what miracle drugs they are. I mean, between antibiotics and vaccines, the mortality rate in a child under the age of 5 was 50%.
Really?
And now it's very, very rare to hear of somebody dying from an infectious disease.
Right.
And so these are really miracle wonder drugs, but they've got to be handled correctly. And we're getting a head start in how we can handle them correctly because of the resistance we found in this cave.
Okay. Our musical themes have changed a little bit in recognition of these bacteria that have been doing this valiant work for us. I give you John Williams' March from the movie 1941. Thank you. You've been listening to Biologist. Environmentalist and geologist Hazel Barton of the University of Akron explained to us where antibiotics come from, how they can be used, and the backstory about the furious wars they're conducting for food. So, what does that mean for the use of antibiotics today? You said we'd have to be careful using antibiotics today. What does this mean for using antibiotics today, besides not taking them for a sore throat?
We need to be careful in that we only have a limited variety that's available.
All right.
And so we have to make sure that the right kind of antibiotics are used to correctly treat the right kind of infections. And so when you go to the doctor and let's say you have a sore throat, there are lots of different things that can cause that sore throat.
Yeah.
But it's a sore throat, we know it's caused by a bacterium. And it's like, well, we'll just administer this drug. Well, that drug might not be the drug that kills that particular bacterium,
okay,
because some bacteria have different structures from others and are more susceptible to some drugs than others.
Right.
You really do kind of need to know what the bug is before you prescribe the drug. And there's a lot of rapid tests now. If you get strep throat, they'll just swab the back of your throat, and they can tell within minutes whether you actually have one particular bacteria or another, and then prescribe appropriately.
Oh, good.
The other thing about antibiotics is that we use them in everything. I mean, in food production, raising animals.
Yeah.
We don't take antibiotics seriously when we go to the doctor. If we go to the doctor, we've got strep throat, they say, here, take these antibiotics. You take them for 3 days, you feel better, and you stop taking them.
Right.
You put the four that you didn't use away in the cabinet, and then, you know, 6 months later, you feel ill again, you take those four. Or somebody's dog had an infection, and they have the antibiotics left over, and they give them to you. I mean, all these kinds of things where we're not completing the antibiotic course.
Right.
So imagine, the way to look at antibiotics is if you have a million bacteria in the back of your throat.
Yeah.
Every time you take an antibiotic, you kill 50%.
Okay.
So on the first day, you've killed 500,000, and you've got 500,000 left.
Right.
On the second day, you cut that to a half. So now you've got 250,000 left.
Right.
On the third day, you're down to 125,000.
Right.
And you feel fine. You feel good, and you stop taking the antibiotics. But you've still got 125,000 of those bacteria left behind. It's just not enough to make you feel sick.
And they are resistant to the antibiotic.
And the ones that are left behind are the ones that are most resistant to that antibiotic, because they're the ones that haven't died yet.
Right.
And so that population blooms, and now what you have is this emergence of this resistance. And that happens if you don't take your antibiotics long enough. It happens if you take old antibiotics. It happens if you take the wrong kind of antibiotics.
Uh-huh.
But all these things have been driving it, as well as the, you know, you go to the doctor, I don't feel very well, give me something.
Yeah.
Even if it's not going to do any good, just give it to me anyway.
Okay.
And
I hear you.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, even close friends who, you know, really smart people and know a lot of stuff, it's sneaky the way that these microorganisms think, and you have to outwit them. And so if the doctor gives you a week's supply of antibiotics and you feel better after 3 days, you've still got to finish the week's supply, even if the antibiotics themselves maybe give you an upset stomach or didn't make you feel very well. You're outsmarting the bug, because when you do that, cut it 50%, 50%, 50% for 7 days, there's essentially not enough left to cause an infection, and your body can take care of what's left.
Right.
So you have to be smarter than the bugs. And the trick is getting that information out to people that is the way to do it, rather than just being like, well, you know, I know better than the doctor, I'll be fine.
So this is outside your field, but of great concern to people in your field.
Yeah, well, I mean, all microbiologists are concerned by this. I think, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, people say, well, why does it feel like the sky's falling? And that's kind of because it is. I mean, people do not remember what it was like when we had the great epidemics. I mean, I teach medical microbiology to my students, and none of my students were ever around when there was a whooping cough epidemic. But when I was a kid, I remember there was a whooping cough epidemic within the city that I was living in. I remember my mom being terrified.
Yeah.
And now, if these kids, you know, they have kids of their own and somebody's talking about whooping cough, it doesn't mean anything to them.
I see.
And I said that, you know, a child and a paroxysmal cough from whooping cough will cough so hard that they'll break their own ribs.
Right.
And you know, students are just aghast. They can't imagine anything like this because they don't remember what it was like. And so it's very hard for people to recognize how critically important it is to human health to maintain these antibiotics and these important and useful drugs, because if we have to go back to that, you know, we're looking at, you know, these mortality rates rising and a whole lot of suffering that doesn't need to be going on.
Well, this show is one way to raise that awareness. You must have your own ideas about other ways to raise that awareness.
I think it's hard. You know, there aren't many places where you can go and talk about what you do without having to get the message across in one or two lines. It's really rare to be given the opportunity to actually explain things, because I think people understand concepts and principles, and you just have to be able to put microbiology in a concept that people can understand, because no one can see microbes. They're all around us. If you look at your hand,
yeah,
you've probably got a million bacteria on your hand. You just can't see them. And so being a microbiologist requires you to visualize and interpret in ways that make sense to you, because you can't physically see these things. It's not like
right.
working on deer or, you know, any other organism you can see. You have to kind of imagine these processes and interactions. But I think given an opportunity, you know, most people can hear this stuff and understand it and recognize the importance of these things. But getting that message across, when people, you know, have an attention span of 30, 40 seconds, it's very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember my parents being very fearful of the idea of bacteria that were anywhere and invisible. It was a new concept at the turn of the century, and I think people regarded it as sinister. Now it's the reverse. People regard it as inconsequential, and in fact, it's
right.
neither.
Right, and well, and there's a middle line. Actually, you have to not be a germ phobe.
Right,
and this is.
Well, we have our own immune system, right? So as long as you don't abuse it, it's your first line of defense, and it's fairly effective.
Right, absolutely. Those organisms that you can see on the palm of your hand, they're keeping the nasties away.
Okay.
Only a few people can actually carry Staphylococcus aureus, because the ability of that organism to live on our skin is kept in check by other microbes that live on our skin. So they are our first line of defense.
Okay.
They help train our immune system.
Right.
Exposure to bacteria that don't make you sick
right.
help prime your immune system, so when you're exposed to something that does make you sick, you're much more able to fight it.
Right.
You see, I certainly see when I go to the grocery store in the shop, you know, parents, they'll have their germicidal hand wipes, and they're wiping down the cart, and they're wiping down their kids' hands, and every time their kids touch you something, they're wiping down the kids' hands. They're doing a lot more harm than good. You
yeah.
know, I mean, if you're feeding your kids in the kitchen, you know, throw the Wheaties or the Cheerios on the floor and let them eat them off the floor.
Because
they're
going
to help.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you, yeah. Like picking up the pacifier so the kid can use it again.
Right. And a lot of these autoimmune diseases we're seeing now is where your immune system, if it doesn't have something to work at,
right.
it's going to keep looking for things to work at. And
oh, really?
We're seeing a rise in autoimmune disorders because the immune system is actually turning on itself. If it's not getting exposed to a lot of these pathogens, it's still making all these toxins and these killer cells and everything to kill something. And if there's nothing out there to get, it's going to go after what it can. And what's left is the human body and an autoimmune disorder. Crohn's disease, we think, might be linked to worms. And so we all used to have worms. We all used to have intestinal worms. And everybody had a certain worm burden, and now none of us do.
Right.
But there's a very specific immune system to get rid of worms, and Crohn's disease may be linked to that immune system. So if there are no worms there, what do you attack? Well, you attack the lining of the intestine, and that's what Crohn's disease is.
Oh.
So there's that positive role that microbes play in our lives. We couldn't digest a lot of the food that we eat without the microbial flora in our intestines. If you were to count the number of bacteria on and in the human body, it would exceed the number of human cells by 10 to 1.
Wow.
So we're much more bacteria than we are human.
Wow.
And they play an important critical role in all of our body systems, even, you know, emerging organisms such as Clostridium difficile, which is also known as C. diff, which is one of those big infections that people are getting in the hospitals.
Yeah.
It turns out that E. coli in our system stimulates the T cells in our body to make chemicals to kill the Clostridium difficile that makes us sick.
Oh.
And if you kill off that E. coli, you end up getting a Clostridium difficile infection. And so it's all kind of interrelated, and all these microbes are doing great things. So there's this one side of it. And on the other side of it are, you know, these super pathogens like, you know, Streptococcus pyogenes, which is the flesh-eating bacterium,
right,
which is resistant to a lot of the body's ability to fight it off. It has, I think it's 27 different ways of defeating the human immune system.
Really?
Very difficult to kill. If you get a drug-resistant form of that, that's almost fatal.
All right.
Then you have things like Staph aureus, which is now becoming resistant to virtually everything we can use to treat it with. A staph infection is a nasty infection. it's the one that will give you an abscess. And for an abscess, it can get into the blood, it can spread around the body, it can give you infections of the bone. I mean, these are nasty, nasty infections. And we saw resistance, multiple drug resistance, to this organism develop in hospitals, and we called it MRSA, for methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus.
Right.
And it was hospital-acquired, and everybody associated, well, it's a hospital environment, there's a lot of antibiotics, this thing is developing in hospitals, it's residing in hospital, you pick it up in a hospital. But now you've got students, you've got 20, 21, 22-year-old healthy students dying because they're being exposed to a community form of this. So this pathogen, this multiple drug-resistant form, this organism, has escaped out of the hospital. It's getting into the community. And because of the way we live, you know, you go share a locker room, share a water fountain. People always think toilet seats, but that's actually usually the cleanest place in a building.
Right.
But because we share a lot of these resources, we can pick these things up. Keyboards are the worst. Computer keyboards are just massive islands of microorganisms, especially those grubby ones where people have used them for years and never clean them, and you have all those skin cells stuck to the surface of keyboards. Those are some of the dirtiest places I know.
Okay.
Elevator buttons. And, you know, these organisms get spread around, and you get a scratch. You can inoculate it under the skin, and then a healthy 20-year-old male who's playing football could end up dying from this infection, and people are looking around like, I didn't even know people died from infectious disease anymore.
Yeah.
But we've got almost no way of treating it.
So was there some conclusion that you wanted to come to that we haven't dealt with so far?
I mean, if there's a take-home message for people, I think it's the ancient nature of microorganisms and how intimately they are associated with each other, and how even in these extremely remote environments that their interactions and processes reflect the larger picture, the more ancient picture of what these things have been doing.
Okay.
So this cave that we sampled in was about 4 million years old, which means that these organisms have been isolated for that length of time, and yet are still expressing and sharing these resistance genes. But what we could be looking at is a system that could be many, many times older than that, potentially billions of years. I mean, the microorganisms have dominated our planet until very recently. I mean, you couldn't see life on our planet 600 million years ago. It was too small to be seen,
right,
which is, you know, a fifth of the length of the age of the planet. So we're looking at incredibly ancient processes, but these ancient processes will still dominate and control the interactions that we have with these organisms in our environment.
Okay. So we're dealing with something that's been around a lot longer than us and is in many ways smarter than us, and we have to be smarter than it.
Yeah. Okay. But that doesn't mean that, you know, all hope is lost. I think that, like I say, we're starting, it's a real renaissance in microbiology now, and it's almost like we're finally getting it. We're finally starting to understand really what's going on. And because of that, the potential we have, even in drug discovery, the other part of what we do is to actually discover new antibiotics, you know, the same tools and technologies we can bring to understanding how resistance forms, we can bring to identifying new compounds. And then it's just a race who can stay ahead.
Right. Well, thank you for telling us that story. And I'm sorry to have held this interview either in an environment that's irritating your throat or while you have the beginnings or the endings of a cold.
Thank you.
Okay.
You know what it is? I think I'm sitting over a heater. I think that's what's doing it.
All right, Hazel. Thank you for your time.
Well, that was fun. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Biologist. Environmentalist and geologist Hazel Barton of the University of Akron explained to us where antibiotics come from, how they can be used, and the backstory about the furious wars they're conducting for food. Now, all the breaks in the show this week are martial. They're all courtesy of the Boston Pops. This one, Joseph Wagner, Under the Double Eagle. Now it's time for Disrespect's review of the news. These are not the news stories that we read to you. These are abbreviations for the radio. We don't have a lot of time tonight, so hopefully they'll be shorter than usual. Premier may appear at Orange Inquiry. Premier Dalton McGuinty could soon take the stand before an all-party committee of MPPs investigating Orange now that the government has come to an agreement with the opposition to extend the legislative hearings. There will be six more days of hearings in June, July, and possibly August, said Liberal House Leader John Molloy to reporters. Extending Orange hearings was part of a deal made between New Democrat, Progressive Conservative, and Liberal House leaders to hold a vote on the budget bill within the next 2 weeks. Tory MPP Frank Cleese, part of the committee investigating Orange's questionable business contracts, high salaries, odd corporate deals, said if the opposition supports his motion, McGuinty must testify. The people of Ontario deserve to hear from their premier, Cleese said. Earlier, Cleese told the hearing of incidents between May and October 2011 in which critically injured patients died after they were unable to get CPR inside Orange's new AW-139 helicopters. A Star investigation has cataloged the cramped interiors of the helicopters and how they were a disaster waiting to happen. Cleese called on the chief coroner of Ontario to step in and investigate. Dr. Andrew McCallum responded late last week to say his office has investigated all Orange cases brought to their attention. The committee heard from fired Orange executive Tom Lapine, a former paramedic, that he knew of some of the incidents and complaints about the helicopters. He said when Orange is dispatched to pick up a trauma or critically ill patient, it's not entirely unusual if a patient dies. The ministry's investigation found that continuous CPR couldn't be performed due to the interiors of Orange's new AW-139 helicopters and that patients in respiratory distress couldn't be provided with appropriate care. And that from the Toronto Star by Tanya Talaga and Robert Bensey of the Queen's Park Bureau, with a quote from Maria Babbage at the Globe. And in a letter, microsurgery with a chainsaw. Re-Canadians frustrated by healthcare, May 23rd. Behind the smoke and mirrors of the Ontario Minister of Health vilifying doctors, there's the hidden story of the bigger changes to come. This isn't a simple cost savings measure, as the government would have us believe, but a fundamental restructuring of our healthcare system. Already, due to negative incentives by the ministry, we are seeing anesthetists reassess if they will provide sedation for cataract surgeries. Cardiology patients are being sent back to their family doctors instead of being further investigated. For 2014, the government's proposed having radiologists bid competitively for contracts. This concept of competitive bidding will likely extend to all physician groups. Why have your kidney tumor taken out for $2,000 when someone can do it for half the price? Maybe you can get a two-for-one? The public is also unaware of the sharp decreases in funding to radiology clinics, which provide more than half of x-rays, mammograms, and ultrasound scans to the people of Ontario. By decreasing funding, Health Minister Deb Matthews is effectively shutting down the clinics and therefore reducing access to imaging. What we are witnessing is a fundamental deconstruction of our system that will give complete control of patients' health care to the same people who brought us such gems as eHealth and Orange. Ms. Matthews' microsurgery with a chainsaw will not end well. Dr. David Jacobs in The Globe in Toronto. NDP unions blast plan to scrap fair wages law. Opposition MP found the measure buried in the federal budget bill. Hidden in the Conservatives' massive budget legislation is a measure removing the Federal Fair Wages Act, another in a flurry of measures by the Harper government that critics say will keep wages low for workers who have seen little improvement in income for decades. Scrapping the Wages Act is one of approximately 70 changes to federal law crammed into the 425-page budget bill. The move went largely unnoticed until spotted by New Democrat MP Pat Martin a few days ago. Known in full as the Fair Wages and Hours of Labor Act, the law requires contractors who've been awarded federal government construction projects to pay their workers the prevailing wage in the region as well as overtime. Critics say eliminating the measure means contractors on federal construction jobs will no longer have to meet the prevailing wage, $20 to $30 an hour depending on the region, but instead can pay as little as the provincial minimum wage, $10.25 an hour in Ontario. Unions, however, see it as another step in a wide-ranging campaign by the Harper government to blunt the power of organized labor and keep a lid on workers' pay. Eliminating the Fair Wages Act will contribute to a race to the bottom on wages, and it's part of this broader conservative attack on labor, said United Steelworkers economist Aaron Weir. The government is also pressuring employment insurance recipients to take lower-paying jobs, changing the temporary foreign worker program in a way that may drive down wages and is tying immigration more closely to business needs. As well, the Conservatives are using back-to-work legislation to block strikes at companies such as CP Rail and Air Canada. Economists wonder how these policies will help average Canadians who are facing an economy with 1.4 million unemployed and wages that, at an increase of 2.1% annually, are barely keeping up with inflation. There are a lot of sticks being waved around and not a lot of carrots, said Canadian Labour Congress Chief Economist Andrew Jackson. He said he can't understand why the government isn't doing more to provide skills training for Canadians, particularly the unemployed, rather than suppressing pay rates. And that story by Les Whittington in the Ottawa Bureau of the Toronto Star. Scientists decry plan to shutter environmental lab. For 6 years, Cynthia Gilmore, senior scientist at the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center, led a research team that annually poured a teaspoon of mercury isotope diluted in water into a small remote lake in northwestern Ontario. The international project was being conducted in the federally funded Experimental Lakes area, a unique outdoor laboratory for ecosystem research consisting of 58 lakes and their drainage areas. Dr. Gilmore and her colleagues from the United States and Canada want to determine the environmental impacts of new deposits of mercury, a powerful brain toxin, into a lake that already had high background levels. The ELA was the one place in the world where they could do that. The center has hosted a number of groundbreaking research projects over its 55 years. Now, as part of its spending restraint, the Harper government has announced that Fisheries and Oceans Canada will stop funding the Experimental Lakes area and close the world-renowned research center by next April if a new operator cannot be found. Supporters from Canada and across the world are signing an online petition and writing letters urging the government to reverse that decision, arguing the center is irreplaceable. In a letter written last week, Dr. Gilmore asked Fisheries Minister Keith Ashfield to reconsider closing the center. By shutting ELA, you remove a critical tool for finding the most reasonable and cost-effective solutions to national and international environmental issues, she said. The small federal investment in the research station has been returned thousands of times over in public and ecosystem health. That by Sean McCarthy in Ottawa for the Globe and Mail. And locally in The Spectator, parents fight to save Canada House. A parent-led movement to save Canada House is gaining momentum. The 8-bed home for teenage boys with mental health issues is in danger of closing if its operator, Woodview Mental Health and Autism Service, can't find the funds to cover the annual operating cost of $175,000 and $50,000 worth of repairs. Go to Save Canada House on Facebook. Donations can be sent to the Kiwanis Club of Hamilton Incorporated for Canada House, 200 Jones Road, Stony Creek, Ontario, L8E5J4. That's the Kiwanis Club of Hamilton Incorporated for Canada House, 200 Jones Road, Stony Creek, Ontario, L8E5J4. Tax receipts will be provided. No attribution. And in an editorial in the PLOS Neglected Tropical Diseases Journal, Dr. Peter Hotez warns of the serious consequences of Chagas disease, which is already widespread among the poor and indigenous groups in Latin America and parts of the southern United States. Chagas disease, which is caused by parasites transmitted to humans by a tiny insect called the kissing bug, is the new HIV/AIDS of the Americas, according to a leading expert in tropical diseases. The disease, named after Carlos Chagas, a Brazilian doctor who first discovered it in the early 20th century, is caused by a parasite known as a trypanosome. The parasite is caused by the kissing bug, which has been described as a cockroach with a long proboscis that allows it to feed on blood. But the parasite itself is transmitted through the bug's feces. When the bug bites someone, it also defecates on them, and the parasite enters the body, Cotes explained. Kissing bug is found throughout the poorer regions of Latin America and southern Texas. Once infected, it can take up to 10 to 15 years for the damage from the disease to manifest itself. Reports suggest there are some 10 million cases in the Western Hemisphere, predominantly in Latin America. About 30% of people with Chagas will develop heart disease. About 3 million of the 10 million infected with trypanosomes in the Western Hemisphere. Of those 3 million, the majority will ultimately die from the disease, Hotez said. Some estimates suggest 20,000 die annually from the disease, he added. Treatment for Chagas, officially known as American trypanosomiasis, involves taking the drug benznidazole for 3 months. But the treatment often doesn't provide any relief and only works if the disease is caught early. If global action isn't taken, Hotez fears conditions may be ripe for what he describes as a perfect storm for infection and transmission amongst the poor. The U.S. Center for Disease Control estimates there are 300,000 cases in the U.S., but Hotez believes it's closer to 1 million cases in the U.S. overall. And that by Deborah Black, staff reporter at the Toronto Star. And a good news story to take you to the end of the news review. These microloans give more than money. A pilot program run by CAMH and the Rotman School of Management provides mentorship for Torontonians with mental health challenges. Next year, it's expanding across Ontario. There were times when Ed Middaugh had no home, no job, and no money. He floated from couch to couch in and out of hospitals during what he reluctantly calls episodes, unable to buy food because payments for medications consumed his whole monthly budget. These days, Mr. Middaugh, 34, diagnosed with bipolar disorder at age 19, runs his own general contracting business where he does home renos, stonework, and landscaping. He's bright, articulate, motivated, and steady, thanks to a better mix of meds. He's also the recipient of an $8,500 small business loan that enabled him to buy a used pickup and power tools, something he never could have imagined landing from a traditional bank due to a sporadic work history. Mr. Middaugh is part of a quiet pilot microcredit project run by the Rotman School of Management and the Center for Addiction and Mental Health over the past 2 years. The partnership gives small loans to people with a history of mental health challenges to start their own business. Often these clients have no access to credit through traditional channels because they lack a sound credit history or the required collateral, or they are on government support. That somebody is saying, "We trust you. Here's your money. You did it. You followed through with what you need to do," says Mr. Middaugh. "Just the level of trust and empowerment I got from that was invaluable." Self-employment is a natural fit for many clients who can't often fit rigid schedules of a regular job because of treatment schedules, anxiety, or mood swings. The program is run deliberately out of the Rotman offices at college and university, not CAMH. There's a dignity when they walk through these doors. They're coming to a business school, not a hospital, and they're treated as entrepreneurs, says the program's executive director, Narinder Dami. And that story in the Globe and Mail by Tavia Grant. And that's all the news we have at Disrespect this week. We have a lot. We've got to get it to you next week, so come back and we will have more. And now, through the magic of radio broadcasting, you get to laugh at my jokes, but I don't have to laugh at yours. But I'm going to give you a chance to get even. There's a new social media tool about to break on the web, Diaspora. They're going to let you own your own content. That is, you can put it up and you can take it down. Like it sounds, Diaspora, diaspora.com. Go there, ask them to let you know when it's let loose. And I'll see you on the web. And you didn't think I'd let you get away without having the last laugh? Alfred, the Colonel Bogey March. Thank you.
Thank you.